A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late-night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Welcome to another fun and exciting mini-episode of the FDH Lounge. It is a reunion here tonight, believe it or not, ladies and gentlemen here. The first coming together in 6 years, almost 6 years, of the old Reality Check crew. You, Dave Adams, have done some shows with the Lounge over a period of time here, but haven't been behind a mic with old friend Ron Glasnap, TV super producer to the stars, in almost 6 years. So, Ron, good to have you back, my friend.
I just came out of retirement for you, and that's all.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
I'm pulling a T.O. and Randy Moss, and I'm going to come back just to make the playoffs.
Well, we appreciate that greatly. 6 years, Dave. You look a little startled.
It's been a long time. Ron, did you make sure you filled out your timesheet for this show?
Yeah.
I think you're going to get paid. Just
there's a truckload of pennies to pay me over here in the corner.
That's right.
Yeah. And here's a shoot, by the way. The first reunion almost was in a van down by the river.
Yes, not proud of that fact.
This
is probably better than the van down by the river.
Probably.
It's almost like
on,
in my mom's
world,
basement or something. You
or
know.
Yours, actually. But,
yeah. In this case, my own basement. So
on
that's
your world,
good.
On your World Series chairs, no less.
That's right. And speaking of World Series, something the Billy Bean hasn't been able to make it to yet. We'll get to that shortly.
Dave, have you been going to Segway school in your spare time, Dave? That was a very nice setup.
I planned that.
That was outstanding. Yes, Michael Lewis's book, Moneyball. We all went to see the movie based on that book a couple of days ago here, and I'm just going to be breaking it down here tonight and giving our various thoughts on the movie and how everything's set up. Have both of you guys... I don't know, I think I asked you this of you off air. Both of you guys read the book?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes,
Dave, you
I
read
have.
It?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. All right. Guess I'll start there because that's the first thing that when you go on Deadspin or some of these other places. I know Deadspin's acting like it's very pedantic to sit here and say, oh, this isn't the same as what was in the book. This isn't the same as what actually happened. But I'll start with you, Ron. I mean, what were your thoughts on that? Did it get at all distracting to you? The things that didn't line up with what were in the book or in reality, or were you able to kind of take it for what it was?
I think whoever wrote the screenplay, because obviously the screenplays are never just as the book is,
mm-hmm.
they really had to make good versus evil.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Bean was the good guy, and the scouts were the evil, and therefore they must butt heads on everything. In the book, as I remembered, it's been a few years since I read it, but, you know, did the scouts agree with what Billy Bean was doing? No. But I don't know that they were ready to, you know, blow him off and not listen to him and, hey, by the way, we're going to do whatever we decide because, you know, you're just whoever. Billy Bean didn't want to hear about scouts who were smelling the grass after a guy stepped on it to see how well he was going to do. Or, well, he's got a great name. I think he'll really be good.
Well, that,
you know, if you've got enough talent, you know, Jaime Schwartz can be a superstar.
That's a good point. I mean, that's a very good point because, yeah, I mean, the scouts were not as opposed as they were in reality, largely because in reality they knew who was signing their checks and they were smart enough to keep their mouth shut. Same as Art Howe also, too. And Art Howe has objected to how he was portrayed in the movie. Yeah, because that's the thing, Ron. I mean, this is a guy who, I don't know what he's doing these days. I mean, he's probably special assistant to somebody in somebody's organization, but he's still trying to work in Major League Baseball, right? I mean,
yeah.
This is going to get in your way if you're portrayed
Art
that way.
Art comes off as almost as bad, if not worse, than the scouts.
Yeah.
And if he had been that bad, he wouldn't have made it past May 1st.
No, that's true.
They would have canned him, especially if it was the last year of his deal, then they definitely would have canned him. Had he been that belligerent in what he was doing, then it wouldn't have lasted at all. He had to be on board somewhat with what Billy Bean was doing, or at least understood what he was doing. The way it was portrayed in the movie is it's Billy Bean against the world.
Yeah, no question about that, because he ultimately... The thing I have to say, though, I'm going to say Philip Seymour Hoffman in that role was tremendous. Always loved watching that guy, and there were just some... Sometimes I would flash back to him being in other movies and guys telling him there's a lot of ins, a lot of outs in a situation. Billy Bean didn't go to that card, Dave. But it was it was very interesting seeing him in that role there. What did you think about the movie versus the book?
Well, I thought that they kind of spent a lot of time, discussing what happened to Billy Beane as a young player, mm-hmm. as a high school player, being courted, and they did a nice job of, looking at the way baseball works, and saying to everybody, well, here's the process. This doesn't always work out, and you don't hear about the ones that don't work out as much. I mean, the fact that Billy Beane is actually back in baseball is pretty big, and I don't know how much he thinks about his past. You know, the movie portrays it as like it's always on his mind. He's always thinking about what could have been or how he was treated or how the scouts saw him and basically what happened to him. He was a bust. But I thought it was okay. It wasn't right on to the book, but I think Ron's right. They had to make it entertaining to watch. I think the portrayal of the scouts was pretty right on.
Mm-hmm.
Being someone who worked for the Indians in the past, I don't know if Mark Shapiro had that many guys in his office, but I guarantee he had two or three. I don't know if he had five or six, but I'm sure he had
the arrogance seemed well captured.
Well, I don't know. I think
the belief in his own talent was probably well captured.
That's true.
You say tomato, I say tomorrow.
Right, exactly. I think they definitely believed in the players that they had always, and it was tough to pry those guys away. But it was funny to see, the trade deadline deals and the GMs from other teams were calling back in like 60 seconds. That doesn't happen, okay? I don't know if it happened back then, but it certainly is not happening now. And they're probably talking more on their cell phones and going right through the secretaries.
Or texting or
doing whatever. I mean, I'm sure there's many ways that they're, especially on the trade deadline day, there's a lot going on.
I can see them sit there with 32 open chats on Instant Messenger to just talk to
them
the whole time?
I wonder
how much LOLs and emoticons come up in those things.
I don't know about it. I mean, I'm sure they will text each other to see if maybe somebody's available to talk on the phone. Mm-hmm. I don't know if they would actually do a deal through texting. It's probably a voice deal, but I'm sure they have the capability of doing either one. I thought Philip Seymour Hoffman did a nice job, but he's just a great actor, and mm-hmm. you give him any role. I mean, he's done Truman Capote,
mm-hmm.
so he certainly can do Art Howe.
Art Howe's not as deep as Truman Capote.
No, not as deep, not as fat as he was portrayed either. But as I recall, Art Howe as a player was a pretty skinny. Be that as it may. I agree with Ron. If Art Howe was that belligerent, he would have been gone long before the season's end. And how many more seasons did he last after that?
Maybe two or something like that.
Okay,
there's a line that he has in that movie that says, look, I'm coaching this way because I got to find a job next year. At that point, if this had been real, Billy Beane would have said, well, you're going to go find a job tomorrow because you're gone.
Yeah, because
he would have been gone.
That same summer in Cleveland, Charlie Manuel was wanting to look to the future, and they basically said, don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way out. So that's a very similar thing. By the way, though, on the timeline, I do know exactly what happened with that, because keep in mind the book came out in 2003. So anything that's in the book, by definition, happened, in that span, like right after the season. If you remember, and this was an inaccuracy with the movie, Art Howe had a contract through at least the next year. He was traded to the Mets. He was Billy Beane leveraged him in a trade.
Right.
So where the movie's like, oh, I don't have a contract for next year, he actually did, and that was key to making that trade, because Michael Lewis said in the book there that he saw him as having enough of a value at the end of the year to where he could extract it from somebody else. He felt like he was done with Art Howe, but by the same token, he won 102 games, so somebody's going to want him.
And we all know that's the way the movie business works. They have to make, the story. They have to make the good versus evil. What was the movie we saw many years ago, Miracle?
Mm-hmm.
Was it Jack O'Callaghan?
Yeah.
He was out for two games, or when it was in reality five, or whatever it was. whatever made it more dramatic is how they kind of tweaked the story. That's why it's always based on a true story, not an actual and complete true story, because those aren't as interesting.
I still wish Miracle had been in 3D, because I would have been ducking every time that Soviet coach turned his head from those eyebrows. That would have been something, Dave.
That's right. That's right. That was something. I remember that movie. That was a great movie. And
it was.
That guy looked pretty right on. I mean, whoever played that role. I enjoyed the movie. I thought it had some human elements to it. You know, I didn't realize that Billy Bean was divorced and had a daughter, and so they brought that in. So that was kind of neat. His relationship with what did they call Paul DePodesta in the
Peter
movie?
Brand.
Peter,
yeah.
Brand. I thought that was pretty interesting. The stats thing is pretty accurate. I think if you would take a look around the league right now, most teams, if not all of them, are really crunching numbers like this. I don't know if they're using them to the degree that they showed Billy Bean using them in the new movie, but you know, most managers have a book on hitters versus pitchers and vice versa.
They're copycat leagues. If it works for one team, then it's going to work for others.
Yeah.
Well, the last one of the last things in the movie was the Red Sox went out and won the title 2 years later by using Billy Bean's basic theories.
Yeah, and there was a lot of truth to that with what Theo Epstein did. And as far as Brand/DePodesta, boy, I can't imagine in a million years why Paul DePodesta would find it harmful to his chances of getting another GM job to be portrayed as a fat, stat-loving virgin on screen by Jonah Hill there. Can't understand why he thought that would be bad for his prospect.
Well, and a lot of teams now, they're not only analyzing like player stats, but they're also analyzing player health and injuries, and taking a look and see, you know, what a pitcher does in high school or college, you know, what does that translate as far as their health, you know. And I'm sure they're crunching all kinds of numbers based on what their performances and what their stats were at those levels, you know, what their body weight is, height, all kinds of stuff. And some teams have, you know, decided, well, we're going to go ahead and rehab this guy and pay for the surgery and hope he comes back, and or maybe take a stab at a free agent that had the surgery the year before. So it's valuable. I don't, you know, look, it's a game. It's there's still people who have to make plays, managers who have to make decisions. There's a big time human element in it. This is just a tool, I think.
Yeah, and it's basically a team is better for incorporating that in there. I don't think anybody would question that, anybody with any enlightenment anyways. But as far as it went with the portrayal on the screen there, this is the one thing where, although I have some issues with the accuracy and felt that it was distracting in places, I have a tremendous amount of sympathy for them, because I didn't feel like it set itself up very well to be a sports movie. People expect the Rocky kind of thing going here, and it was a situation where this didn't set itself up well. The movie begins with them losing in the playoffs in 01, and the movie ends with them losing in the playoffs in 02. So you're creating a lot of other things there. Now, the ways that they chose to work that in, it was a situation where they put all the change that winter versus the change had been building for a while. They'd been doing the sabermetric stuff leading up to that point. So for dramatic purposes, they did that. But it's a movie that didn't lend itself to that, Dave. And the one thing I'll say is, they didn't take the easy way out. They could have gone for the Rocky ending, as pathetic as they made them look, if they ended it with a 20-game winning streak. But then, right after that, there's a scene in the movie where Billy Bean's like, well, doesn't matter if we don't win the World Series. And I'm sitting there as a theater going, wow, because they don't. And, you know, spoiler, I know the ending. And that took some guts to deal with it that way, because it was a little more of an art house film and not having the classic happy ending.
Yeah, I didn't. It was kind of neat, because I had forgotten that they had, you know, I knew that they had made the playoffs and everything and got eliminated, but I had forgotten the 20-game winning streak completely.
Mm-hmm.
So that just watching that was kind of fun. And, you know, there's a lot of history in Oakland. You know, they kept showing it. You know, the Oakland Athletics have been, you know, gosh, they won, what, three World Series in a row or two out of 4 years or whatever that was in the 70s.
They've been the Jekyll and Hyde team of baseball for 40 years.
Yeah. Right, because they were total crap at the end of the 70s, early 80s.
Mm-hmm. After winning three titles in the early 70s.
72 right. to 74, yeah.
Yep, and then they got completely gutted. And then you remember the Billy Ball days in the 80s when Billy Martin went out there and Ricky Henderson and all that. And then after
Rick
that,
Honeycutt
they were...
had like 500 innings.
They were crap
Matt Keogh
again.
Loves him.
Yeah.
That's right. They were crap again, then came back in the late 80s, early 90s.
They juiced up.
They got all that. Tony La Russa, all that. And now they've kind of been, the last 10 years, they've been, you know, back and forth. But they are, you know, if you look at their roster and the type of players that Billy Beane brings in there to compete, and they always finish around 500, even if they don't make the playoffs. They're around, I don't know what they won this year, maybe 75 games or something like that. It's hard to believe that they're as competitive as they are. And they've had a lot of injuries with their pitching staff.
They have.
You know, last year those guys were lights out, and now they're two or three of them are on the shelf for the year.
Well, and in the movie, they really focused on guys like Scott Hatteberg and some of those others that they brought in.
Yeah.
The A's still had Tim Hudson, Eric Chavez, Miguel Tejada. It's not like they were completely dead of talent.
Yes.
When Damon and those other guys left in free agency and Giambi. Yes, those were great players and whatever else, but, you know, the cupboard was not bare from where they started in 2002. Were there holes? Yes.
They didn't talk a lot about those other players.
They didn't say much at all about Chavez and Tejada and Tim Hudson and Billy Koch as their closer and whatever else.
Yeah.
They didn't say anything about that. They were just as important, if not more so, than the Scott Hattebergs and the guys that they signed to fill that Jason Giambi hole.
Well, here's the thing, too. Hudson, Mulder, Zito, and Koch never mentioned, to my knowledge, in the movie. I didn't hear him come up once. Now, and that's the thing where we can sit here and we can say, and you're a good person to ask about this, Ron, because I know you being in the TV business, you and I talk a fair amount about narrative and the way that things get presented and sold here, but is that going too far in trying to present a story here? Because a team like that is never going to be pathetic. Like they were trying, oh, this is the bad news, Bears. Come on. At the very least, they're going to win their fair share of 1-0 games. Was that like a bridge too far, completely ignoring those foundation players in the movie?
I know all three of those guys, or at least three out of four, were not rookies. They were, it might have been their second year, at most their third.
Pretty well. Some of them, they were a little established, at least.
They were a little established, but they were not what you would call, you know, solid season veterans either. They were in their, I mean, I don't think any of them was above 25. Mm-hmm. So you could have had them bounce either way of what's going to happen to them. Did they finally get a book on them and now they know how to hit them? Or did they move past the hitters and go, okay, now I'm going to find another way to beat you, plus the way I was beating you before? But, again, that doesn't make the story if you say, oh, by the way, the team wasn't loaded, but it was still pretty decent.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't help with what they're saying. And actually, they didn't say so much about it in the book either, about those guys
right.
and the guys that were currently on the A's. Actually, in the book, they did a lot more on the farm system of, you know, that I'm not going to take Jeremy Bonderman because he's a high school senior and it's going to be 6 years until he's in the majors versus a college guy who's actually put up numbers.
Well, the thing that was interesting about that, Ron, was that in the book, really the centerpiece of it was the 2002 draft. And going through, and that was where Billy Beane was really sort of defying the old school way of doing stuff here. And in a movie, with wanting to show a resolution during the 2002 season, that way of doing it was going to be untenable. So essentially what they did, they took what was the heart of the book, that middle part there that had so much emphasis, and it seemed like they shoehorned it into the off-season previous, where this is how we're going to fill out our team for this year. It seemed like that was the direction they were going in. And while they did some things that were unorthodox with Scott Hatteberg and some of the other guys in there, it was interesting, Ron, that they took the one device and they used it in another way.
They completely focused on the major league roster because they had to. If you focus on the minor leagues, the movie's 9 hours.
Yeah.
And nobody's going to go see it.
Yeah. Then it's a Ken Burns thing.
Right. And if you but those guys, most of those guys that were in the minors may not have actually had success in Oakland. Maybe they were traded like a Jeremy Bonderman, or maybe they were, you know, whatever, they were shipped around. They did a little bit in the movie about Jeremy Brown, the 260-pound catcher.
The Badger.
Who all he could do was hit,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that was the emphasis, if you haven't read Moneyball. The emphasis that Billy Beane always put on it was, who cares what he looks like? Who cares if he's not 6'5"? Did he hit 320? What did he do the next year? Oh, he hit 330. And as he went through free agency and paying these guys, it was not about what they did in the past. It's what are you going to do in the future? Same problem is about 7 miles away down at the Indians ballpark where they're trying to figure out what to do with Brady Sizemore. Do you pay him for what he did in the past, or do you pay him for what his future might be after 3 years of injuries and whatever else? That's where the general managers of the major leagues really have a problem now, is they're trying to pay them for what the future is. Players want to be paid on what they've done in the past.
Yeah, and it's a movie that works on a couple of different levels because it's dealing with these baseball issues. But inevitably, if you have a cast that's got Billy Beane, Jonah Hill, Philip Seymour Hoffman, you're going to have a story crafted around that to be able to make it a little bit more mainstream and applicable to rom-com lovers and those type of movie theater patrons. So it was a thing where ultimately they did kind of flesh it out in that way. And there were some story elements of this thing, Dave, where, again, we talk about the inaccuracies with the baseball stuff, but some of it was accurate with the family. You mentioned specifically about Billy Beane's failures as a player and being a prospect that did not pan out. It might have been nice in the movie, if they'd have gone into a little bit more detail about what you mentioned, because in the book, it kind of makes it clear that 2 and 2 equaled 4 in his mind eventually, that, like, hey, I'm a perfect example of where scouts think they know something, but they don't know crap because I wasn't all of that. It would have been nice to see him in the movie work that into his own motivation about finding better ways to get players so that he doesn't end up with a roster full of Billy Beanes.
Yeah, you're right. They didn't really get that far. I mean, they kind of showed what happened to him, but they didn't. He never really said to anybody in the organization, you know, I don't want what happened to me to happen to these other guys.
There was a throwaway line, I think, from Grady Fuson about, you're just obsessed because of what happened with you. And I read the book. I know what that was, but people must have been scratching their heads if they didn't read the book, Dave.
Right, right. I agree.
It was hinted at, but it wasn't blatantly said.
Yeah.
When he had those flashbacks of him playing and whatever, that's what he meant was, look, everybody told me I had 5 tools. Turns out I had maybe 1.5. I don't want to get some other guy who they think has 5 tools. We give him millions of dollars, and he stinks.
This is the trap of knowledge, though. We read the book. We know that. Do you think somebody that didn't read the book is going to sit there and have a decent chance of getting that from what they saw on the screen?
Potentially. I mean, I think they really have to pay attention to the movie.
Okay.
Yeah. But the movie, you could have watched the movie and not read the book and still got the gist of what was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably the goal of the movie, is they don't want to have to rely on somebody having read the book to go see the movie.
You don't put movies out for niche audiences. You put movies out for the mass.
Right.
And a baseball fan is a niche audience. Baseball fans enjoy the movie for a different reason than Joe Average moviegoer.
Right. And if you look at the numbers and what this movie has brought into this point, that makes perfect sense. I don't think it's, not going to set any records.
Titanic's record is safe.
Yes. And I think the fact that they're releasing Lion King in 3D, I think that's going to beat Moneyball as well. But, it's a niche audience. I mean, very few people are going to get around to see it.
How many people were in the theater when we saw it and it had been out a week?
10.
10?
Yeah.
If that.
And we saw it at just before 10 o'clock.
Yeah, I mean, it was 9:50. It was a late night. It's not a date movie.
Like I said to my dad, though, as far as like making it like a date movie, my advice to my dad was, I thought it was almost sort of like borderline, because maybe women can relate to the stuff about, oh, Billy Beane's daughter and everything like that. There might be enough of that in there to appeal to women. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. Would you rate this better than, let's say, The Wrestler?
As a date movie, it's significantly better than The Wrestler. As a date movie, it's better than then again, you wouldn't believe half the movies I've been able to get away with as a date movie. I was lucky enough to get away with Starsky and Hutch, if you can believe that. That was a pretty cool girl. I couldn't believe I got away with that.
You didn't go Dutch that night, did you? I hope you paid for every damn bit of that movie.
Oh,
so twice.
I'm sure it was on DVD.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you know, it's. I thought it was good. I'm sure I would have taken my wife there. She would have enjoyed it, and she would have got some of it. She has no idea who Billy Beane is, but she understands baseball, and she would have been intrigued by the inner workings of an organization. And, mm-hmm. and you know, look, watching Beane walk in with Oakland Raider crap hanging all over the place, I mean, the Indians dealt with that for years because they were under the, you know, they had to be down at Cleveland Stadium where Art Modell and the Browns were king.
Mm-hmm.
And the Indians were just a tenant. Same thing that's happening to the A's. You know, small offices, you know, small clubhouse, small weight room. Everything's old. You got to pay for your soft drinks. That reminds me of back in the day at Municipal Stadium with the Indians. You know, and they really had a hard time controlling their own destiny until they got, you know, out of there and got their own place. He's pushing for that now.
I think it's also ironic that we've been talking here for, oh, probably 20 minutes or so. Has the name Brad Pitt been brought up yet?
That's true. I was thinking about bringing his name up.
We keep calling him Billy Beane.
Yeah, is he in the movie?
The man's name is Brad Pitt. Now, the reason that he is the star is because he's also the producer.
Yes. Right.
So that certainly helped with salary, and it's a little more of an, as you call it, an art house film. And
sure.
Not even an art house film, but an art house film.
Nice.
And you can see why he wanted to do this, because he liked the story, and it's his production company, so that's probably why it got made. He did fine. He wasn't quite believable as the ex-athlete, because I think Brad Pitt's all of about 5'10", and Billy Beane was about 6'5", and 240 at the time, or whatever. I don't know that I bought that he's a 40-year-old plus ex-athlete, but the other stuff within it of running the GM and, you know, dealing with things and how he dealt with the people and the egos and whatever, that I bought a little more.
I think that's why, though, they cast him next to a pre-weight loss Jonah Hill. He certainly looked more athletic by comparison, did he not, Dave?
Yeah,
so
I
do
agree.
We.
Yeah. I agree. And I'm sure Brad Pitt's hitting the weight room just as hard as he in real life as he was during the movie.
Oh, I'm sure he is.
But, and I don't know, does he chew in real life?
He does now.
That's right. If he didn't before, he's hooked now.
Yeah.
The method actor. He's got to get into his role.
That's right.
Joe Garagiola says that's a bad thing.
That's right. Yeah. I don't know. I thought Brad Pitt did a nice job. You know, it's kind of funny. You always, you know, you joke around with people or celebrities or famous people always joke about, well, who do you want to play you in the movie? And they always throw out Brad Pitt. I'm not sure if Billy Beane thought of Brad Pitt first, but he really had no say in it. But I thought he did a nice job. Is he going to win an Oscar? No. I don't know. Hopefully it'll open up. I was just glad Brad Pitt shaved.
Yeah,
you know,
that's true.
His face off.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, because he looks like, you know, Ho Chi Minh with that other crap that he had on there. But, so that being said, I thought he did a nice job.
I thought so, too. I'm not a huge Brad Pitt guy, but no, I liked his performance in it. I thought he did good. The thing that was funny, I read a story where Billy Beane was talking about this, that what was happening when they were preparing to make the movie. Billy Beane was talking about one day at home. He noticed early in the morning that his wife was getting her hair done, and he noticed that his housekeeper was wearing a dress. He'd only ever seen her in jeans before. He's like, wait a minute. And then he's like, oh, I think they heard that Brad Pitt's coming over to meet with me. And indeed, they had heard about that, Dave.
Nice. Yeah, I'm sure they got all dolled up for him.
But, no, I thought it was a pretty good movie. I mean, on balance, you guys thought it was pretty good. I mean, grading on the curve of the difficulty of making the story. It's not a classic sports triumph story. I mean, I thought it was pretty good. You guys concur with that?
Yeah, I think it's more in the line of a kind of a, I don't know what you would call it. You wouldn't call it a strict sports movie, I don't think.
No. A sports-ish movie.
Yeah, I mean, I bring up The Wrestler because, you know, not that that's a strict sports movie, but it kind of was like a day in the life of a wrestler where mm-hmm. this was more of a day in the life of a GM. And, you know, basically went through a season I don't know. I guess I would compare it also to, you can't really compare it to Tin Cup, but.
Well, you know what? I don't know if you if you've seen Warrior yet, but Warrior.
I have not.
I thought it was similar in that way because Warrior really, and surprisingly so, I didn't expect this to be the case when I went to go see it. It really is a human drama story that's got an MMA thing grafted onto it.
Okay.
So this kind of had a little bit of the same thing. Warrior was probably more so along those lines. And honestly, I mean, I've already copped to previously, main reason I went in the first place is because FDH Lounge dignitary Jake Digman is up on screen doing his MMA ring announcer role in there.
So I
went to support one of the crew.
Yes.
But yeah, I happened to see a pretty good movie while I was at it. But it sounds like that's what you're getting at with your opinion, that it's a thing of... That it's not purely based on a sports thing, and you don't have to be a huge baseball guy to see it. Is that kind of what you're getting?
Yeah, I agree. I think if you're not the biggest baseball fan, I think you'd still get it. You probably would have to be somewhat knowledgeable about baseball, but it wouldn't have to be a prerequisite, I guess.
Well, the good part, as you said, you couldn't pigeonhole it as you were. Right. Talking about how, where this film fit. I'm running through the sports movies in my head.
Right.
And most every one of them either ends in tremendous victory or tremendous defeat or some kind of tragedy or a true ending. Whereas this one is a continuing story. Now, there is not going to be Moneyball 2. I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
But, you knew that this was going to kind of continue. And, by the way, this is how the Oakland A's are. They didn't win. They are not, this didn't work and change the world and now Billy Beane's going to run for president or something.
Right.
It was, this is what we tried. This is how we kind of changed our world, our little corner of it. However, in the end, it still wasn't enough.
Right.
And that's might be where most people can relate to it is no matter what you do in your life, you can change all you want. You can be happier. You can do things differently. But sometimes in the end, the big guy just comes in and steps on you.
And there's
and
a
that's
lot
what
of,
the Yankees did.
There's a lot of sports movies like that that in the end that it's not it the hero doesn't win.
The first Rocky. For as much as people talk about Rocky movies and the underdog always triumphs, what better example, Dave?
Exactly. First Rocky, the original Bad News Bears movie.
Mm-hmm.
Which,
by the way,
but Rocky didn't lose either.
It sucks that you couldn't make a movie with Tanner doing all of his stuff today.
Right. Yeah. Those kind of movies, when they're remade, they lose something.
That's why they shouldn't be remade.
Right. Major League is another example. They lost in the end.
Yes, but you didn't see that on...
You didn't see that in the movie, but they didn't
screen.
Win the whole thing.
In
right.
the end, they win the division, they beat the curse, they
right.
beat the bad owner, et cetera, but
right.
you never see them lose in the division series until Major League 2, when it's, oh, by the way, the Indians tragically lost in the ALCS,
right.
whatever it was.
To whomever.
So, yeah, whoever.
I don't even know who that was.
White Sox, Yankees,
yeah,
whatever.
All in all, I'd probably give it like a B+ or something like that if you're looking for a rating. Certainly something I would recommend seeing to those people out there looking. I just talked to the guy I golfed with tonight. He's planning on seeing it. He's a big baseball fan. Some of the other things in there, that the round table with all the scouts with the donuts and stuff, I'm sure that's like right on, and everyone's spitting in a cup and... Guaranteed. If you were a baseball scout,
I don't know if I trust a guy that's got an ugly girlfriend.
Exactly. Definitely 20 years ago, at least, these guys were sitting around a table and were they chewing? Yes, without question. I don't know where they got the Indians front office shot from, but that there is no resemblance at all to that
from the LA studio they shot it in.
Yeah, exactly.
Made it up.
Mark Shapiro's office and his, gang of assistants, like 8 of them in that room. No.
Although, wait a minute. Am I the only one? I have been in Mark Shapiro's office.
Okay.
It's a lot bigger.
Yes, it is
a
lot bigger.
And it could easily put that entourage in there and have room to spare.
Yes.
That one, for movie studios, it was, a shoebox compared to what
I've never
really
I've never been in there per se, but I've been told there's a dartboard that's got my face on it.
Let me add at least one.
Actually, that's where he wipes his feet.
I've got to at least one baseball operation story. This is from this is from when the strike was going on. This is
from when you were with the Indians. Let's
I was with the
that.
Indians.
Yes.
94 season stop. That was when the Indians were technically going to be the wild card team.
Right.
Season canceled. So, I don't know, it's like November, December, and Major League Baseball's talking about, the strike is still going on. They haven't reached a settlement yet. We're one of the few organizations that really hasn't got rid of anybody. Maybe we got rid of two or three people. But we're basically doing ticket refunds, helping the ticket office, run through these ticket refunds that we had to do. So I go walking up and seeing one of the to see one of my buddies in baseball operations, and he was seriously working on putting a roster together for spring training. The reason this never went down is because there were probably half the teams in the league that didn't care about this scab baseball. They weren't even putting any time into it. The Indians were. So I'm just walking around, how's it going? He's got this list of players he's working on contacting to see if they're interested in coming back, mostly former Indians. And it was really the Latino players had wanted no part of coming back. So I just threw a name out there. I'm like, well, how about Carmen Castillo? What did he say? Yeah, he said no. and it was true. Any of the ex-Latino players, absolutely not. They didn't want any part of it, no. And the players that they were going to put out there were just
guys who God never made it.
Awful.
So we never got a chance to see Bernardo Brito.
Oh, he would have said no. But it was a joke. But that's one of my baseball operations stories.
I may still have it home. They handed out the media guide for the 1995 SCAB team.
Oh.
They didn't find it. They didn't make it into an official media guide. It was one of those things that was about 100 sheets of paper with one of the metal clips on the top. And it was, kind of written out as 1995 Indians media guide or whatever they called it.
Right.
But there was no way they were going to do real media guides or any of that sort of stuff.
No.
But I figured that's a collector's item. I think I have somewhere.
You still have it? You have it in your archives,
I think it's somewhere in a closet.
Yes.
What's the first question?
I'll get a lot on eBay for that.
First thing that comes to mind, how many would-be Jim Thorpes cross-trained and were also part of the fake 87 Browns, Dave?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Those are the good old days. Was that the year Modell brought a couple guys out of, or they crossed the line?
Bernie
the
crossed
end, right?
the line and left. Ozzie
he crossed the line.
He crossed the Bengals.
Yeah. Made the playoffs.
Yeah. The Bengal UPS drivers.
He had a bunch of ex-USFL guys that crossed the line because they weren't part of the union anyway. So they
didn't care. That's right. That's right.
Mike Johnsons and those kind of guys. They weren't part of the NFL union at that time, so they could care less. Like, yeah, let's play.
If you didn't know it was scab football, you would have known when you were watching the game and you saw Bernie running a bootleg from 50 yards out.
Yeah,
hey,
exactly.
Wait a minute.
We can run any play against them. I will say one other thing I saw, Ron mm-hmm. the guy who played Ron Washington. And
there should have been more of him, by the way.
Yeah, he seemed pretty well. Did he manage the A's after they let Art Howe go? Or
never
was there somebody
them,
no, I believe he was third base coach.
Ken Macha was in there for a
yes,
period of time. Yeah.
Ken Macha, okay.
Yeah.
And I believe this. I used to not believe this. I used to believe that you could probably pretty much throw anybody at first base. But when he said it was extremely hard to play first base, it really is. There's a lot into it as far as short hops and, how to hold runners and just play different angles and things.
Then why do they keep throwing everybody at first base when they can't play a position?
Well, because that's probably, out of all of them, the easiest to teach. I know it seems that way, that it's very difficult, but it's the easiest compared to anything else. I mean, outfield, you've got to have some legs, you've got to have an arm to get it in. So if you're not fast and you don't have a great arm, you're not going to the outfield.
Well, and you also need speed in the middle infield because you got to be able to cover some range there. And then third base, you have to have the instincts like that if it gets hit at you.
Third, I will tell you, in my experience,
process of elimination, it seems
coaching
like
baseball, guys and kids who play middle infield positions, shortstop, second base, they don't want anything to do with third base.
Nope.
Because it's the ball gets to them too quick.
Especially in an aluminum bat league.
Yeah.
Ugh.
You know,
no wonder I was a third baseman.
Yeah, I mean, it's like playing goalie. But first base is, you know, you look, Adam Dunn. You know, you could throw him there. Matt LaPorta, they kind of converted him. Carlos Santana is playing some first base. You know, you can get away with it, but you also, to be exemplary, you really needed to work at it. I mean, when the Indians had Paul Sereno, I mean, they were working on him all the time.
Anybody remember the old stories? I obviously was not old enough to see him, but Mickey Mantle ended his career at first base.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't play the outfield anymore.
Right.
And my guess is the Mick didn't work at it. The Mick worked at hitting the bottom of the bottle rather than going out with his first base glove.
Right.
But that was, you know, because he couldn't hack it in center field anymore. They didn't move him to left. They put him at first base.
Right.
And I would think left field, he probably still had some wheels at least a little bit. You know, he could have gotten away with playing left field, but, you know, he couldn't.
Oh, he can't.
They probably wanted to save his legs.
Probably.
Had to be a real transition, though, because we're talking about this kind of stuff. And with Hatterberg, you got to dig the throws out of the dirt. You got to do that kind of stuff there. You really got to, I mean, you talk about third base being a goalie, but in a different sense, first base sort of being a goalie also. It's not like the puck's getting hit at you, which would be the third base analogy, but for first base, you've got to be able to stop the loose puck from getting in the crease, so to speak, here. So it's a different set of challenges. So I think the long answer to your question, Ron, is that it's a process of elimination. First base is not a great thing to learn defensively, but compared to everything else on the diamond, it probably is the easiest thing to do.
Yeah, and usually you have a bunch of coaches, at least one coach who's played a little first base in their career, so that helps a little bit. And you can hide people there. Not as much anymore, because you got, the infielders aren't as good either. They're just throwing the ball over, and you have a lot of times they're wild throws. So you really need somebody with a good glove over there.
No, personally, when I coach teams or help with teams, if I'm going to hide somebody, now I've only coached kids, but I hide them in left field and third base because most of the kids can't pull it.
Yes,
in a major league, that's different, certainly, that more guys can pull it, but they also don't have to think it is a reaction.
At the higher levels, the baseball gods, they will find you. I remember once in high school,
the baseball gods always find you.
We had a kid who slid in a home plate head first and sprained his wrist back badly. His throwing hand.
Of course.
So this is a high school game. So we sent him out. We iced it down. He came off the field. He was out at the plate. We iced it down right away, and we sent him out there, and we put him at first base. So we told the pitcher, anytime there's a play at first, he needs to sprint over there and then get the ball from that kid playing first base in case there was a throw to be made, because the kid at first wasn't going to be able to throw the ball at all. Sure enough, the first pitch pop up right to the kid at first base. He made the catch. He couldn't do anything else. But that ball will find you quick.
There's a line from the book that should have made its way into the movie somehow with Jeremy Giambi, where he's out there, where he gets put in left field, and Michael Lewis was saying in the book there that it was like he was thinking, please don't hit the ball at me, or if it does come to me, please be so kind as to hit it right at me.
Yes, yeah. If you're out there thinking, don't hit it at me, it's going to find you.
Yeah.
I don't remember in the book, were there any stories of Billy Beane trashing locker rooms and telling the players, that they were in there dancing?
I don't remember that.
I don't remember that in the book.
See, that's a movie.
And I think that was movie magic
He may have done that.
Well, he may have, but it wasn't. I don't believe it was in the book at all.
Exactly. Although, again, some of that veered a little bit close to throwing bats in the shower. I was having some flashbacks on that.
Yes, lollygaggers.
Lollygag ball around the infield. But
I think one of the bats actually made its way into the shower. It sounded like it hit the shower room, but
it did.
They never showed it.
Well, actually, though, Ron. Actually, Ron, you hit upon something. This was one of the things there that was actually based on some reality. It wasn't that he saw Jeremy Giambi doing this stuff. It was that I think the word had gotten back to him. He was kind of rowdy on a flight afterwards. I think that he'd gone to Vegas on an off day or something. It was just basically these things that were getting back to him, you know, separately. But it was based on real sort of peak with the way that he was acting, because that's how the John Mabry deal came to happen. Because Michael Lewis even said in the book that was not a money ball trade, and that was something where Billy Beane himself subsequently admitted, look, this was something I basically did as, it might have been an overreaction, but it was a reaction the way the guy did it. So that was actually based on true stuff, Ron, but you're right, it wasn't based on the exact events that were presented on screen.
And I don't know that the trade of Carlos Pena was done at the time to make sure that Scott Hatteberg played either.
Yeah, he wasn't an all-star.
No, he was not an all-star. He was a year or two later, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, he was not traded because, well, you've got to get Scott Hatteberg in the lineup. I don't think that's why he was traded. He may have been traded because of the Moneyball theory,
mm-hmm,
and that he was, you know, all pop and, you know, his OPS was 450 or something, because he never walked and he struck out too much.
Where did he get traded to? Tampa Bay?
Detroit.
That's right.
Was that the three-way deal? I think, and the Yankees might have been in that also.
I think that was part of the Bonderman deal.
Yeah,
Bonderman. Originally, that's how Bonderman ended up in Detroit.
Yeah, that's how that happened. And then it was a situation where, and I subsequently read an interview with Scott Hatteberg, and he said, because Hatteberg was very quick to say that Art Howe was always a backer of mine, he was a supporter of mine. He said he didn't want to play me that much at first base, but I sucked. But he said he DH'd me a lot. He got me in the lineup. He got my bat in the lineup. And he said they might have moved Pena as a way of getting me some more time at first base. But he said it wasn't a power play on Art Howe. It wasn't like that was the case. And, again, Carlos Pena was not an all-star or an all-star on the verge as it went there. But, Dave, you had said B-plus you thought overall. I would say, you know, roughly it comes to about the same thing here. Ron, what would you guess for a grade for it?
Yeah, I would say a B is probably good, I mean, mm-hmm, for what it is. If you're a Joe Average fan, I think it's harder for you to follow. Mm-hmm. If you are no offense to anybody, matter of fact, I talked to one woman who was going because it was a baseball movie. I thought she was going just to watch Brad Pitt for 2 hours. In fact, she was actually into it for watching the baseball part. Had they wanted to make it a more generic movie,
mm-hmm,
Robin Wright Penn or Robin Wright or whatever her name is now wouldn't have been in the movie more than three scenes.
Oh, that's who that was. She looked familiar.
What part was that? I'm
she
was,
that was his ex-wife.
That was his ex-wife.
Oh, okay.
That was the mother of the daughter.
Right.
So, and, you know, with the husband who didn't know anything about baseball.
I like the girly man's second husband. That was a funny touch.
Yeah. He tried to slough it off like he knew something about the game.
In the Birkenstocks. Yeah, that was him.
And they tried to make this a more general movie for more people.
Uh-huh.
That would have been, you know, the ex-wife would have been across town, not across the country, or wherever the little girl was flying to all the time.
Right.
It was basically up and down the coast. I don't know if the movie mentioned that or not.
Not really.
Okay.
Yeah, because they were living in Seattle, and he was in Oakland.
Yeah, so. Yeah.
I thought it was San Diego. Maybe I'm wrong.
No.
Or maybe they said Seattle in the movie.
I think it was Seattle.
I don't believe it was Saskatoon.
In real life, it was San Diego, but okay.
Okay.
But anyway, had they wanted it a more general movie, she would have been across the street as opposed to across the state.
Right.
You know, I don't even really know what the point of that was, other than to get Robin Wright into the movie and put her name on the marquee.
Well, you mean the relationship between him and his ex-wife and the new husband?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah, it
wasn't part of the movie. It wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, it's just real life. It's reality.
Yeah.
You know, my daughter has a cell phone and I don't know about it. You know, throw that in there. You know, let's talk.
And as I told you guys as we left the movie, I haven't heard a movie or seen a movie in a long time that uses silence as so much as this one did. There are times where he's thinking and contemplating, and in most movies, that's where the Darth Vader music begins, that's where you start hearing other sound effects, that's where comes in. This thing, it was dead silent. Now, also there were 10 people in the theater, which made it easier to be silent. But there are times, I mean, it was 10, 15, 20 seconds of nothing.
Well, like when he went in the locker room.
That day.
Yeah.
When he went in the locker room and he said, you know, he stopped and there was a long pause and he's like, this is what losing sounds like.
Mm-hmm. But that was made for emphasis. But there are times where he's either doing his inner monologue or talking to somebody. Or, well, I think it was a narration that he was doing. And it suddenly it was just And that silence was 10, 15 seconds long. No music, no gnat sound, no nothing.
In his truck.
In his truck or whatever.
Times, right.
You know, usually you would hear some sappy song on the radio so they could sell it on the soundtrack, and they didn't do that.
Even the conversations had some spaces. The Art Howe confrontations, there would be some spaces in those. The things with Steve Schott as he's in his office, as Schott is doing his whole thing about, you know, being the kind of goofy owner who doesn't really have enough funding to even run a team properly. And,
by the way,
what are you going to do, Billy?
Do you think the second meeting with Schott was total fabrication?
Yeah, I think
so. They said by July we'll be seven games out of first. And, gee, it just so happened they went out and won 20 in a row. And then they were, you know, 25 games above 500 and two games out or whatever it was. I mean, that was a little too convenient.
I liked Schott's sweaters, though. They were pretty... You know, sharp. Yeah, I know.
They were.
But if you're that rich, I tend to think you might have a little better sweater.
Probably.
Yeah.
I think they were going for eccentric rich guy.
Yes.
In his case.
I mean, he is sharing a tenant with Al Davis. That's got to rub off somehow.
Yeah, and boy, what an indignity for Billy Beane. I mean, when your office in the building isn't even as big as that of Darth Vader down the hallway here, that's got to be an indignity.
The Athletics?
Who are they?
You know, we're all athletic here. Yeah. You know,
but to bring it full circle, yeah, I thought it was pretty good. It sounds like we're all basically on about the same page, B plus, whatever. So this it was fun to be able to break this down with you guys here. I look forward to doing some stuff here in the near future. We've got the Pantheon coming up relatively soon here. So Dave,
cool.
you've sat in on the Pantheon previously.
I have. Yes.
Ron, you haven't had the chance to do that, but you voted in it a few times.
I've voted several times.
You have voted, I think, every time in it here.
You haven't been a sock puppet yet, have you?
No, I don't.
I'm sorry. Did I say something?
Oh, yes.
I shouldn't have.
Several fantasy drafts. I was there, but I wasn't there. Yes.
And here's Ron. His pick's coming right up via instant messenger. Oh, I'm sorry. I've divulged too much.
I have no idea what you're talking about, Mr. Adams. I have no idea what you mean by that.
Are you breaking down the fourth wall? Yeah. Is that what you're doing? You can't kayfabe? Huh?
I think I am. If you're going to break kayfabe, could you do it about the fellow that we used to broadcast with and not me? Would it kill you?
I would have never taken Mike Vick in the first round. Whoops.
That was Mike Billy that would be saying that.
Mike Billy.
Yes. Yes, the one and only. Outstanding. All right, well, thank you, gentlemen, very much here on Moneyball. Great to get the reality check reunion going.
Let's do it again.
We'll do it again sometime soon. Thank you, fellows. Dave Adams and Ron Glasnap along with me here, Rick Morris, for the reality check reunion for Moneyball.